This is the Living Legacy Project with Alan Bigelow on August 15th, 2013. So Alan, let's start with some of our more basic questions. I know you don't describe yourself as an artist explicitly, but what inspired you to become a digital writer or an artist or however you want to describe yourself?
A complex response to that question. Because when I think about it, a couple factors are involved. I mean, I was always writing. I started writing poetry and fiction when I was a kid, when I was 12. And obviously I did that for many years until about 1999. And I had already a couple of short story collections and a novel, and a novel or two under my belt, and, you know, and some success, but nothing outrageous. And then around 1999, thanks to my wife Elizabeth Licata's help, I discovered the web and started to explore the web a little bit more. Actually, 1984 actually is when I discovered the web, but 99 is when I started to think about writing and how writing could be adapted to the web. And what I saw on the web was just simply transcriptions of text onto the web, and that seemed like a waste of web space. You know, when you can do multimedia on the web, why would you just stick with just text? And so I was starting to think, well, you know, maybe the web would be a great place to tell a story, but we'd have to think of different ways of telling a story or writing a poem. And so in 1999, I actually wrote my first putting my foot into the water was actually putting my foot into fire, because I wrote a novel, an interactive novel. That was the first thing I did. It was a flash novel. It was called Pamela Small. And it's actually still accessible online at pamelasmall.com. And it's a full-length novel. And it actually was a text novel that I had originally written, and I just sort of sitting around. And I'd constantly revise, and I thought, well, I'll start with this. I have the text, so why not now make this interactive? And so I actually created this interactive novel, Pamela Small. And I'm not sure if it's a complete success, but it certainly did teach me how to make words work with images, animation, video, and other kinds of multimedia aspects on the web in a way that, of course, never considered when I was just writing them as text. There's also an ancillary response, and that is around 1999, I started collecting domain names, thinking I could make a killing. And so, I'm ashamed to say now that I bought, and by the way, I didn't sit on anyone's, it's not like I bought IBM.com or anything like that, much as I would have liked to if I could have gotten something like that in 1999. That was gone in like 1989. But I did have a whole bunch of domains, and one of them was cinema2.com, and I still have that. And actually, when I think about it, I have to go back for a second, because actually cinema2.com was actually the first piece I ever wrote. That was followed immediately after by Pamela Small, because cinema2 was a very small, short piece. And I had this web, this domain, cinema2.com, and I thought to myself, well, I better do something with the domain, or someone's going to come after this domain and take it away from me, and I want to sit on it and make millions of dollars off of it. Like much like that. And it was what I decided was I made cinema2.com into a fictional company. It's a company that they move you. It's a moving company, but they move you. And in other words, they give you a catharsis. And that's they have a therapy, they have a built-in therapy, they have like these specialized electronic instruments that they apply to you, and you come in and you talk, and they examine you, and they say, well, this is your problem, and we're going to move you. And then they talk with you and work with you, and eventually they move you, and you have a catharsis, and you're cured. And so that was actually the first one. And I did it simply because I wanted to make sure that if anyone came after that domain name, because cinema.com, by the way, it sold for $700,000. And so I thought, well, cinema2.com, what could that be worth? And of course, it turned out to be worthless. But in any case, that domain still directs itself to that first short story. And then immediately I followed up with Pamela Small, and that was actually the learning curve was Pamela Small. Mm-hmm. When you do a novel length work on the web, in a new application like Flash, you know, as a writer like me, I have no technological know-how, but I simply just immersed myself in it, and that's certainly one way to learn how to do something is just simply get your hands utterly, completely, disgustingly dirty.
Could you mention a little bit about some of the technologies you were working with?
In fact, starting in 1999, I just wrote a series of almost 30 Flash pieces over the years. They are all Flash, starting from, you know, in 1999, of course, it was an earlier version of the application Flash. But then, of course, you know, each year or so, a new revision of the application would come out. So I simply, you know, just reuse, you know, go through those new applications. versions of those applications because it was convenient, and Flash was such a really beautiful way to create what I wanted to create. I mean, those, and I still think to this day, though I've moved on to HTML5, I still think to this day that Flash offers, it still offers, the best combination of animation, text, video, audio, and everything else that you can think of that you can put together under you can put it into a single frame, mm-hmm. and that frame, as long as a browser can accept it, will see exactly what you created. There are no differences with Flash file, so I could send it to any browser and they would see exactly what I wanted them to see every single time, as long as their browser was Flash enabled. And Flash was such a user-friendly interface as well, and just so good at using multimedia. It's just a shame that Steve Jobs decided that he didn't like it, and he basically, one man, virtually killed a really beautiful application. For a lot of artists, we have been, and some still use Flash, but most have been moving on. So I used Flash from 1999 till about 2010, and then since then I've been doing maybe 2011, I'm not sure, but I've been doing HTML5 since then.
While we're talking about this, you speak so highly about Flash, but what are some differences you've noticed with HTML5? Some things you might like about HTML5 or some challenges that you encounter?
Downside of HTML5 is not nearly as user-friendly in terms of interface. I mean, you basically got to be code with HTML5. With Flash, you didn't have to do that much coding. That's much coding anyway. And it's not as good with audio. It's not as good with... They're getting better with video. The beautiful thing about Flash is actually this is where the word artist does come into play, because what Flash created was basically a canvas, and you could do anything, you could put anything anywhere on that canvas and do virtually anything you wanted on that canvas. And it's like I said, you could then send that canvas to the browser and anyone could see exactly what you created. HTML5 doesn't create a canvas per se. It doesn't create this ideal blank artistic canvas that you can put anything any place. I mean, ideally it can, but it's not nearly as easy as it was for Flash. Mm-hmm. The good side, though, for HTML5 for me, I don't know, I'm not sure what people who read my work are thinking about it now. I've had some good responses, but then I don't really know. Is that it's forced me to completely change my way of writing, which has been an interesting experience for me. It's been challenging. Where before I would, in Flash, I would emphasize the visuals and make sure there's some sort of storyline or poetic line in there, and have a lot of interactivity involved. Now the visuals have been downplayed, the interactivity has been downplayed, but then recognizing that a linear storyline that you would typically see in any kind of story, whether it be web-based or text-based, recognizing that that wasn't really going to cut it for me anyway, has forced me to, reassemble the story, so right now what I'm interested in doing, and what I have been doing for the last three or four pieces, and in fact I'm doing a whole series on these, is trying to take archetypal images, text, video, audio, and mixing them together in strange ways to create a story, but without it actually not being a story at all. If you can understand what I'm saying. It's very difficult to describe. I don't think anyone, I know a lot of artists probably say this, I don't think anyone's tried to do this before. like the piece I'm working right now, and I can tell you this because I know that no one will hear this for a while because I don't like talking about works that I'm working on. But I'll tell you the piece I just finished. It's called My Life in Three Parts. All right? The first part was all borrowed from, as if you were online and you were buying something, and a series of advertisements with buying icons, but each advertisement somehow archetypally had something to do with me. And at the end of that, I had a little sliver of a video of a cartoon, and that would be the end of that part. The next part was I took some classic artworks, Picasso, Modigliano, and so forth, right? And then put captions under each one, and interpreting the picture. And through those interpretations, if you read them, I was hoping that people would get a second sense of me, in addition to the first part. And then the third part was, I actually had to create a new language for the third part, And that was, I took a series of mathematical symbols, and that part was, I think, called how many times. And so how many times have I, you know, woken up to a new day? How many times have I drank a beer? How many times? And then I connected those all with the mathematical symbols, meaning different things, and then made equations out of each one of those, out of the sections of that part, all leading up to the end, which I won't give away because it would be anticlimactic even when you do see the end. So in any case, what I'm trying to do, as I mentioned before, is try to experiment with the whole idea of how to create a narrative without actually creating a narrative. And so the idea is to sort of obliquely play media off of each other, text off of video, animation off of audio, and see by creating a contrast between them, creating something in that space, within that contrast, that has meaning, has narrative meaning.
When might we have an opportunity to see some of these works? Are you going to be putting them onto WebYarn?
Well, they're all, that one I just mentioned is on WebYarns already.
Okay,
it's on the newest, there's a link on the upper left-hand side called Newest WebYarns, and that's the newest one. Someone actually wants to publish it, did some book already, so it wasn't even published before that happened. But the website's going to be completely redone in about 1 month, hopefully. So then you'll find it in some other section. I don't know where. But yeah, it's been... So moving from Flash to HTML5, at first it was dismal. It was, tools of my trade have been traded in, have been replaced with a totally inferior tool. But instead of crying, which I did for a while, I said, okay, well, adapt or die. And so I said, but let's adapt in some way that makes use of this new tool in a way that would be fun for me and different for me and maybe something completely new for everyone else when they see it as well.
That's phenomenal. And really exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing some of that.
Oh, well, it'd be interesting your feedback, actually.
When you were talking about My Life in Three Parts, you were talking about injecting some biographical references into a narrative that in many ways is much more focused on intermedia. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the relationship or the balance between your biographical information in your works and fictionalization, and where perhaps historically that's played a role and where you see that playing a role moving forward into like HTML5.
If I understand your question correctly, the biographical... the introduction of autobiographical material into otherwise not autobiographical works. My father, who's now dead, would have denied this. But when I was an adolescent, I think, he knew I was a writer or wanted to be a writer. And one of the things he told me that stuck with me, as I said, he'll probably deny it, was the shortest book that one would ever write would be the book about yourself. That pretty much turned the page for me. And so I recognized, well, if I'm going to write about something, it better not be about me. And although I have led a somewhat interesting life, it turns out that I've distanced myself from myself in virtually all of my work, including that piece, My Life in Three Parts, is a perfect example. I mean, here I could have said, you know, I was born here, I did this at this, and the second part was this, and just straight narrative, and instead I did it in a completely off-the-wall way. More avoidance of, you know, examining who I am, which I think a lot of artists would probably agree is probably one of our main reasons why we do art, so we don't have to actually look ourselves in the mirror. Let someone else do that.
It's true. In many ways, absolutely, I agree with that. You know, and I think that's the role of criticism. In many ways, is to see the relationships that the artist does not need to make explicit. You know, that's not necessarily their role.
Yeah. There's another story about it. It's so apocryphal that there's no names involved and no dates or anything. But some famous writer had written a book, and some person came up to interview and said, "So is it true that your book is really about this?" And the writer's response was, "I never knew that until you told me now, and I'm sorry you told me." Yeah, he didn't want to know. So I guess my autobiography is sort of written within the works. You could probably do some sort of psychological analysis of, you know, my work and other people, artists' work, and discover, you know, then you can come to all sorts of conclusions. But
Do you see yourself in a position of writing contemporary fiction, or do you see yourself as trying to create a new model?
That's a really good question. That's a question that really a lot of people in my field have no real answer for. I mean, we don't even know what to call what we do. Electronic literature happens to be a name that we use currently, but there's been other names for it as well, anything from net art to digital writing to whatever. Electronic literature is in favor now because the ELL, the Electronic Literature Organization, is probably the main organization that has the conferences and organizes the databases and so forth associated with this field. I personally, and I've expressed this to my fellow ELO members, I personally think that the less we start to identify it, the better off we'll be. I think it is simply an extension of standard fiction, textual fiction, fiction that's text-based, based on the page. It's simply an extension of it, in fact, a natural extension. It's, in other words, just a technology, as it always does with many art forms, has simply pushed the envelope a little further into how you use the same or similar tools to create the certain effects. And so I think it's dangerous to talk about electronic literature like it's something separate, for example, like it's different, because it really isn't. And in fact, I can prove it. I can prove, for example, the electronic literature, which most people talk about, you know, as if it's some strange hybrid that no one even knows about. And in fact, it's true. You could go into a bar or museum and just, you know, stand up on a chair and say, how many people in here have heard of electronic literature? And if you're lucky, one person will raise their hand kind of hesitantly. I think maybe I have. All right. And in fact, when I do a talk, for example, I'll actually point to a wall, like a huge wall like this. In fact, that's what I did here at the Birchfield when I talked here the other year. And I'll say, this is the internet. Way down here in this little tiny inch, half an inch here in the corner, that's the world of electronic literature or net art, right? But in fact, that's just not true anymore. Because, and as I said, I can prove it. All you have to do is go to Facebook. If you want to see people telling stories using text, audio, video, animation, image, it's all happening there. People already accept that stories are multimedia events. There was maybe a couple of years where people were not sure about it, but it's so common now that it's not even worth mentioning. And so I try to encourage people in electronic literature world, listen, don't even say this is different. Say this is simply literature. That's what this is. It's not electronic literature. It's just simply literature. And that's how I personally view it. But once again, when I describe what I do to people, it's so strange. It's a strange schizophrenia that people have. They're on Facebook every day doing exactly what I do. And yet if you come up and say, well, have you ever heard of stories that are created using multimedia? They'll go, no, that sounds really strange. Yet they're doing it every day themselves. They're writing, oh, this is what happened to me today, and here's an image or here's a link. And it's all there, played out. And yet, talk about looking in the mirror. They don't see that the mirror that I present is them.
So you describe that what you do is a form of literature, but would you say that there are different complexities involved with what you do than perhaps people who focus on just a flat textual medium in comparison? Is what you do similar or different than contemporary fiction in that way?
Yeah, I'd say there's two answers to that question, from the perspective of the author and the perspective of the reader. From the perspective of the author, it's much more complex because obviously, you're not just dealing with text, you're dealing with other things as well. So, and you have to make them all work together. They have to synthesize, right? They can't pull against each other and fall apart. They have to integrate in some manner. From the viewpoint of the viewer, the jury's still out. They've done studies, what part of the brain is working when you're reading text on the page. Are you more engaged there than you are, say, with a hypertextual situation? A multimedia situation, the act of the reader is that act a more vigorous act when you're actually reading bare text or not? That I don't know the answer to that question, but it's certainly I know people have studied it, and but for me ultimately, because I have to look at myself as first I look at myself when I'm creating something I'm an author. But that I always think about it as a reader as well. And one of the things I think about is one of my tests for creating anything. It's actually when I do creative workshops or something like that, I talk to people who want to write. One of the things I say is never write anything you wouldn't want to read yourself. Ever. Never. ever. That's the bottom line. And that's the bottom line that I hopefully always remember when I write something, is it has to be something I want to enjoy. I would enjoy reading myself. If I somehow stumbled onto it, you know, out of the blue and didn't know I'd written it, you know, would I enjoy reading it? There is a story about Giuseppe Verdi, you know, the composer, Joe Green. A friend of his went to a concert, and they left the concert together. And his friend said, "So, Giuseppe, how did you like the concert?" And Giuseppe said, "Oh, it was pretty good. I particularly liked that second piece. That was really good." And so his friend said, "But Giuseppe, don't you know, you wrote that piece." Now, he had attained what I think a lot of artists would love to attain, is that kind of objectivity where you can look at your own work and pretend you're seeing it for the first time, as a reader would say, for example, with my work, or some artists with their viewers. That would be ideal. But I think as an artist, you have to work on both levels, as a creator and a consumer.
You talked about your process. You talked about how you use Flash and how you moved to HTML5. But are there any components that you outsource to other programmers, or that you rely on the expertise of people who are more in-depth in the programming field for what you do? Or is everything that you create through your authorship?
Good question, and the answer is emphatically, I do. Yeah. I do outsource. Not recently. HTML5 has been actually getting easier for me, because actually a lot of the code is boilerplate. But I make no bones about it. If you go to my site, you'll see that I actually write about it. I talk about, you know, I'm not an expert in so many ways. And so instead of me relearning, you know, something that someone else already does really well, I will simply beg, borrow, but I won't steal. I'll beg or borrow that thing from them. And it's actually quite common on the web. But, you know, we all do it all the time, in fact. For example, that piece I just mentioned to you, my history, my life in three parts. The second part with the series of artworks that I do commentary on. The video, I just went online and I found a video of a guy teaching portraiture and how to do a great portrait. And I thought, that's right. I want to use that. So I emailed him and I said, "Gee, I got this little tidbit here. I'd like to use it if that's okay with you." Now, by the way, I found it on YouTube, and it was a Creative Commons. He had already labeled it Creative Commons. I could have taken it without even contacting me at all. Creative Commons means you can reuse with attribution, but you don't have to contact anyone. But I did out of a courtesy, because he was obviously a professional. He's actually good. So I contacted him. He said, "Fine, you know, and no problems." And that would be a good example. The most recent piece in HTML5 I've been using also use a kind of a slider effect that I have, where if you're using a device, handheld device like this, for example, this being an iPhone, or something else, you know, you can slide your way through it. That slider effect was some open source code. And actually, that's one of the things about HTML5. It's a good thing it's all open source. So yeah, they want you to use it. And I give credit, though. If you go to the credit pages of any of my work, you'll find often a long list. Now, before I go further, there are some people that I've worked with that have done what I consider like stupendous jobs. Tammy McGovern, for example, has done some coding for me in the past, things I just could not code. And one piece she helped code for me, and I'll tell you the effect that she did, was This Is Not a Poem, where I took, I keep on forgetting the author's name, but I took that poem, there's nothing as beautiful as a tree. I've forgotten. Perhaps you've done the research and could tell me. But in any case, what I did was, that poem I found on Gutenberg.org, so it's public domain. And what I did was I created it as if it was a disk, as if it was a CD disk, right? And this was a Flash piece, by the way. And so what you could do with your cursor is you could put your cursor on the disk, and you start it, and it starts to spin. And it's me, my voice, saying this poem, reciting the poem. And then as it continues to spin, if you take your cursor and swipe it over the words in the poem itself, the words fly out from the center into the edges. And then as each word is removed from that center, my voice no longer says that word. And so my voice continues, though, and skips past that word and continues, in other words, saying the same poem again and again, but each time it's different, because more words or different words have been removed from the center. Tammy made that effect. I told her what I wanted, and she made that effect for me, that it comes out like that and spirals out from the edges. That was something I could not do on my own. Yeah. That poem actually won me a major award, and that was great. That flew me to Paris, put me up for a few days, and it was nice.
Awesome.
Yeah. I couldn't have done it without her. I gave her credit when I did my acceptance speech.
In regards to using mobile technology, what direction do you see intermedia online work moving towards, such as the combination of all these different components and now with this handheld device that makes these works even more transitory in different ways?
Transitory, as we discussed before, is the matter of archiving, and that's going to be the permanent problem that you'll have with creating works that will, within, as you said, within sometimes even months, no longer be viewable. This example of electronic literature that came out in the middle 90s that are, you can't see anymore. You literally can't see them anymore. But there are archiving efforts right now in universities around this country and abroad to actually save those pieces. For myself personally, when I started carrying an iPhone around a few years ago, I realized I was writing works that I couldn't see on my own portable device. And that was another reason why HTML5 seemed like a way to go. Now what I do is I create for portable. You can virtually any device, although there are some problems. Like, for example, I'll try a Samsung every once in a while, and it won't place right. So I'm still working out the kinks, and I'll probably be working out the kinks for the rest of my life, as long as I'm doing this stuff. But to me, the idea would be to place it as many places as possible, have it play as many places as possible. So a desktop, laptop, handheld, portable device, you name it. Now, whatever next generation device they come up with, like if iPhone comes up with the wristwatch, whatever that wristwatch is going to do, hopefully they'll be able to play anything that can play on the iPhone, but you never know. And what it means is, and I hope I'm addressing your question in some way, what it means is it's actually a huge struggle. As a writer, writing, certainly, if I had to go back to your original question, one of your earlier questions, like, you know, what's it like, you know, writing in text versus writing multimedia, I'll tell you one thing with writing text. You didn't have to worry about how people were going to see it. Once it was published, that was it. But the problem was, once it was published, you couldn't change it. And that was the beauty part of being a multimedia, where you can instantaneously change anything you want. So that's a very big time-consuming thing. Is when you're creating, it's really time-consuming to create a work of art, and then you have to spend days, sometimes weeks, making sure that it's viewable in multiple devices, across multiple browser platforms, across language barriers, and the list goes on. All right, I don't even bother with language barriers, by the way. I mean, I've had some stuff translated in other languages, but I don't do that. I'm not going to go there. But it's a constant struggle, and I don't think it'll ever end. I think, as you said before, it's permanent. If I can get technical just for a second,
yeah.
Not so technical.
Please.
I mean, one of the questions I've been asking myself is, you know, well, do I do an app? Okay, and the beauty about an app, as you know, is when you can download it on your phone, and then it's like truly like that Flash file I was talking about before. You see what you get, or you get what you see what you see what the artist wanted you to see. But then I recognize that it's challenging. Okay, you have to download the app. Then you have to, which is sometimes easy, but you have to download. Then you have to, it's just local. So I've so far opted for online, which I believe, and for me, has this kind of universal appeal. And for me, that is as an artist, because any place, if they have the correct technology, can view it or experience it. But I have no idea. A year from now, maybe the app will have to be the way. You know, I've been thinking, toying with an idea. Actually, that's just between you and me. I don't care. But what I wanted to eventually do is create an app that becomes like this holder for stories. And so you can download the app for webyarns.com. Webyarns, right? And then you can update. And when you update the app, all it does is pour in the newest stories, and you just play them out of the same app every time. But Apple is pretty restrictive in terms of what they allow you to do, and particularly when it comes to creative things. I've had some friends who run into problems. Because I've actually cold queried, if I can use that, instead of cold called.
Yeah.
Cold queried from email. Magazines. Like, you don't do this yet, but have you ever thought about publishing these kind of things? It's actually, the trend now is actually, apparently, from what I can see, is the moving a lot of some literary magazines are actually moving towards incorporating more so-called electronic literature, right? And they're still calling it electronic literature, but it's just literature, right? So that's interesting. It's a trend that I think is going to continue, actually.
So you kind of touched on this, and I've got a sense of it already, but regarding your source visual and sound materials, it seems like that's a very intentional process for you of selecting what you include based on copyright and Creative Commons and even what's open source from a programming perspective. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, that's all. Yeah. Safe to say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
I'll also use, clipart.com,
yeah,
where I pay $14.95 for a week's worth of unlimited downloading of images that I could then go take into Photoshop and change any way I want.
Yeah.
So
I noticed that in one of your... Oh, I think it was in Science for Idiots.
I took some public domain comic strips from the golden age of comic strips in the United States, the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, and then I took them into Photoshop, took out all the text, and then refurbished the visuals because a lot of them were aged, and so I've enhanced the color and refurbished the visuals, and then I put flash animations on them in the background, and then animated the and then put new text and animated the text, and I created a series of three of those. That was fun. That was fun.
It looks like a really fun project.
Yeah,
it looked like a really fun one. I'd like to talk a little bit about the technological aesthetic that you have been working in and where you see yourself going forward with that. Perhaps because many of your works were created in the late 90s and the early 2000s, but some of your works on webyarns.com.
Well, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
To make sure, for those people who don't know what a yarn is, a yarn is a story, a fanciful story, imaginary story. So web yarns. That's the problem with dealing with the language that's constantly changing, is that the definitions of terms disappear.
Yeah.
So I periodically ask my students, anyone know what a yarn is? And most don't.
Really?
Yeah. So I've got some colleagues who say, why don't you just use alanbigelow.com and just make it stick?
I don't think that's as fun.
Yeah. But it doesn't make much sense if they don't know what yarns means.
But at the same time, if you Google Alan Bigelow, it's the first result that comes up.
Yeah, I know. But when you talk about branding,
right,
branding is important. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. Sorry.
Yeah. What's the name of the piece? The Quick Brown Fox?
Pangram.
Pangram, yeah. That one was really phenomenal. I enjoyed that one a lot.
That's a lot of clip art images.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually pretty easy to put together also. That was a flash piece. That was actually, I was asked, commissioned to do that piece by SF MoMA, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. So, $200, nothing to get excited about, right? But a colleague was doing an online series, and so I was one of the people he chose to do, so I'd made that piece specially for that series.
Mm-hmm.
I had a good time with that, actually. I kind of enjoyed it. I'm surprised that piece, it was there, for them, it worked for them, and it's been in some festivals and shows, but hasn't got, some pieces clicked with the public more than others, obviously, right? But that piece never really seemed to click with the public as much as I thought it should. But
I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. Actually, that makes up the difference right there.
Yeah. All right, so now let's get into some of your biographical history. Can you tell us a little bit about where you went to school, where you did both your undergraduate and graduate work and advanced degrees?
Born and grew up in New York City with weekends and summers in Connecticut. Went to Buckley School, a small private school for grammar school in New York City. Then went to a series of four high schools. Won 2 years at a boarding school, Brooks Boarding School, which was probably one of the worst experiences of my life. I mean, you actually had to wear a uniform. And then half a semester at New York Tutoring School, which is probably the elite, highest cost school in a private school in New York City, and then Julia Richmond High School, which was free and also a terrible experience and one of the worst educational experiences of my life, and then ended up at Friends Seminary for my fourth year, and then went from there to 4 years at Bard College, and which the best years of my life, as my father told me when I was going off. He said, you won't think this now, but this will be the best years of your life. And he was so right. But I didn't think it then. And then University of Colorado in Boulder for my master's in creative writing. And then SUNY at Buffalo, State University of New York at Buffalo, for another master's in English and a PhD in English. Now, that's my formal education. My informal education, of course, is every freaking day. I'm on the web, learning, reading more electronic literature, reading new things about this and that, and constantly striving to grow and change.
As we all should, right?
Yes.
Education is not just an academic experience, and I think that's something that is not spoken of or nor given enough credit within our current cultural ideal.
You talk to most of my students, they just want to make money. They want to learn just enough to make enough money.
So speaking of your students, can you speak a little bit about your professional career, your day job, or whatever you want to call it? Or
While I was doing my PhD at SUNY at Buffalo, I took about 4 years off to write fiction, straight fiction, and then finished the dissertation and got a job for 6 years teaching part-time at Madai College, and then finagled that into a full-time job at Madai College, and I've been there for 20 years as a full-timer. Interspersed in that, for a couple semesters, I was a PhD and master's advisor for De Montfort University in the UK for their media program. People have contact, students have contacted me to interview me and things like that as part of their coursework, and I guess I'm straying a little bit here, but I'm a lot of course curricula, you know, use my work in the United States and around the world. Not an excessive amount. I mean, I'm not famous, but, you know, more than any time ever that I would have achieved if I was just still a text writer, mm-hmm. text-based writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people talk to me about, you used to be a text-based writer, you know, what are the perks of what you're doing now? You're just like this esoterica. You're like this avant-garde stuff that no one even knows about. And I would just like get very frank and say, okay, so how many people read your work today? And they'd say, well, you know, I had published a book last year and had a run of 2,000 copies or 5,000 copies. And I'd say, that's very good. That's good for text world. That's really great. World of web, you know, you can get a couple hundred people a day reading your work or not. Even if you're getting 20 people a day added up over a course of a year, that's more than most mid-rank published writers. That's about where they are, mm-hmm. right? And they're thanking the Lord for that, right? But the world of the web, that's one of the reasons why I went there also, is because it offered this unlimited audience. Unlimited. Unlimited. Not to say I have that, by the way. I don't have that kind of, you know I think I just hit 200,000. You know.
But still, that's quite impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
So working in a web-based medium offers some really unique affordances when it comes to the democratization of access and taking access to literature outside of this kind of traditionally capitalistic structure in many ways, where people don't need to buy your works to access them. Does that influence why you chose this medium or how you relate in this medium or anything about it?
That influenced why I went into the medium, somewhat, right? Although I was also bored, mm-hmm. I was bored writing paper, right? And also I wanted to protect my domain name, don't forget, right? So otherwise, what I make doesn't, I just make it for the web, that's all. I mean, I think somewhat about audience, but I really don't think that. Once again, my primary audience is myself. I've got to be able to please myself because the sense of play isn't in it, like I'm having fun. Mm-hmm. If I know I'm on a good track if I actually laugh out loud while I'm working on something. Or if I cry, which has happened once or twice. But otherwise, the medium in this case is not the message.
We were talking about, from text-based writers, maybe get a run of 2,000 or 5,000. What that made me think about was, even those 2,000 or 5,000 people who read that work, within the structures of literary industrial complex, if you will, You know, there's...
I love it.
There's... there are constraints of how people can access your work. You know, if people don't have access to the historical knowledge about a topic, or if they don't have a library card, there's all sorts of restrictions on how you can access text-based works. But really, when it comes to what you create, there's a lot of freedom for access. But at the same time, if nobody knows what you're doing, you know, if nobody knows to search for webyarns.com, or if nobody comes across it in their hyperlinking journeys throughout the internet, they might not come across it as well. So,
and there's, and in addition to that anonymity that the web offers so resoundingly for virtually everyone, is not 99.9% of people on the web are not virtually anonymous, right?
They're
never seen. Are never known,
right?
You know, most people surf the same dedicated, 20 sites every day, and they stray occasionally through links, but they otherwise, it's funny, you think that the unlimited world of the web would offer an unlimited readership and also unlimited offerings for those readership, but as Google well knows, because they track us, and they know this through the tracking, and then they take advantage of the fact that we're all, in fact, in this whole world of the internet, we actually just choose a very, very, very small little part of it that suits us, and we just simply ream ourselves like that mouse right into the hole there and just sort of sit. But there's also another restraint that you didn't mention that's very important that applies just as much to the world of the web as it does, for example, to text space, and that is economics. There are economic restraints to reading on the web. If the a large population of the world doesn't have a handheld device or access to the web in the same way that you and I are so accustomed, it actually does sort of raise the specter, if you can call it that, but it's probably not a specter. But it raises the issue of is the web in essence, does it create an economic hierarchy, and are the privileged the ones that are able to read on the web, and the underprivileged the ones that are not, and what kind of distance does that create in terms of stratification of society? Those would be interesting questions to pursue. I'm sure someone's already pursued them, but obviously you have to follow up with that by adding, of course, that as instruments, handheld devices like this get less and less expensive, and as the web internet access becomes more and more ubiquitous, that we recognize that the percentage is going to fall of people who don't have access to the web the same way we do.
And that's a great point, and I'm glad you brought up that other side to the coin, because it's absolutely correct. Yeah. Thank you for that. Who are some of your most important influences in terms of mentors, influential artists, or even peers?
I've been asked this question before, and so I just went to an old interview and I just lifted it, because I don't remember this stuff. I'm sorry. An idiot. I'm good in certain situations, but I'm not. For example, I would never make a great game show player. I can't think on the spot to save my life, unless I've been drinking and perhaps doing other things. And then somehow that seems to electrify my brain, and I'm able to think in ways,
Like I said, if we ever need to do a follow-up interview with the six-pack.
Really dig yeah. deep. but so what I did was I printed out a list of some of the influences, okay? And first of all, let me preface it by saying, one of the things I tell people when they ask about writing electronic literature is to say, first of all, like I said before, listen, you're on Facebook, you're writing it already. Okay, anyone can do this. In fact, I have it on my site. If I can do this, anyone can do this. Right? I have no technical abilities whatsoever when I first started. Nothing. I didn't know Flash. I'm left brain, right brain, left brain, right, whatever, however they call it. So I not only don't have abilities in that direction, but these days, almost anyone can create a website and using open source code and tweak that and add images and text and create stories the same way I'm doing virtually. Or you could do it probably in a week. You could create something like I'm doing. It may not be quite as polished. It may not be quite as successful as I hope that I'm producing, but you could still do it, right? So that democratization of the web that we've been touching on, that does seem to include in terms of like anyone can do this, right? If you all have to have access to a domain name, that will cost you $12.95 a year, and then your server costs are $9, $10 a year, or $10 a month. And then you're all set. right? So once again, the economy comes in, right? Not quite a democracy like we'd like to believe it is. So, but maybe in some ways, I have to admit, I mean, you know, that I was in some ways, regardless of how people may think I'm successful or not, right? I am maybe more suited for the world of multimedia writing than some of my peers, especially nowadays as students are going to college, because I was required, and I always did, I grew up in an environment in New York City. I had access to music, the best museums in the world. I had access to the best books in the world. You know, I was reading. I would deliberately go to the Met on some weekends, and deliberately lose myself in the Met. I literally walk in the door, and I would wander as deep as I could in the Met, and then just simply, it wasn't a matter of finding my way out. It's just simply a matter of, okay, this is where I am now, and I would just simply admire my way out, and just look at everything on the walls, and just sort of wander around until I exited into the, you know, blinking into the sunlight, and there it was. Wow, I got lost in the Met again. How beautiful was that? All right, and so I had access to those kinds of things. I traveled a lot when I was a kid. You know, junior abroad in London. My parents we had enough money that, you know, upper middle class, and so my parents took us a lot of vacations around the world. So I had knowledge in that area, and so the idea of multimedia for me comes almost naturally. I was a music major in college, so it seemed, when I started to do this stuff, it seemed natural to start to mix things together. And maybe when I reflect on it, I realize that maybe I have some advantage over other people in that area, perhaps. All right. So in terms of influences, then, my influences are far and wide. Now, by the way, quick segue, like a lot of students today in college, they're forced to major in their first year. I mean, I see this in my students all the time. They don't have the access to liberal arts that I did. So, but fortunately, the web gives them that access where their colleges don't. And so they're exposed all the time on the web to visual stimuli, to how things can look. You know, they can go visit the Met on the web. These things are, although they never will, most of mine anyway. So when you talk about influences then, I mean, we're talking about a wide variety of influences, anything from musical artists to more traditional fine artists, to writers. And so here I'll throw some names by you because I have it right in front of me. Writers, there's theater. I also loved theater. I used to volunteer at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in Waterford, Connecticut. I used to go there in the summers and work as in the kitchen, cleaning dishes, and then I'd go see the rehearsals, and I got to meet Martin Esslin and Arthur Miller, and the list goes on. I met these famous people and got to watch them work. And then while they were breaking, I'd go up to the library and I'd read plays, and then I'd go clean dishes, and then I'd go out and watch them rehearse. And so in the world of theater, you know, we had Sam Shepard, who I did my dissertation on, Tom Stoppard, Jean Beausart, Pirandello, Sophocles, and then in poetry and fiction, you have Lawrence Stern, who in the 1700s was, I wish some of these guys were alive now and doing what I'm doing, because Lawrence Stern, you know, this is a guy, as novelist as you know, who, you know, in the middle of the novel, he'll have a page that's entirely black. That's his idea of a good time, and that's my idea of a good time too, where you can play with the page. And these guys would be such naturals for the world of electronic literature. T.S. Eliot, John Barth, James Joyce, Samuel Beckett, Emily Dickinson, Natalia Calvino, Jean Paul Sartre again, and the list goes on and on. Music, you know, anything from experimental to whatever. It's really the broad panoply of these artists and writers and musicians and just thinkers that created, I think, sort of the bedrock on which I built what I do. But I believe that same kind of, I believe everyone exposed in the same way those kinds of features and have the same kind of opportunities presented to them. So I still believe that anyone can do what I do. I seriously believe it. And I think maybe people are better trained now than ever I was. I mean, no one ever trained me to become what I do. I just thought of it. In fact, when I started doing it in 1999, I didn't even know about electronic literature. I didn't know other people were doing it. I thought I was the only one. And in fact, I was one of the few. But there was a guy in England, and we just stumbled across each other's work. He's a really great writer. I'll remember his name in just a second. He has his website, dreamingmethods.com. Andy Campbell, he's a terrific writer. But anyway, I think I emailed him once and said, I'm doing something similar to what you're doing. And he said, wow, I'm, you know, and then we started communicating, and it was suddenly the world became a lot smaller. So influences all over the map, fortunately.
I want to talk to you about a specific relationship you have with someone that you went to school with in Colorado and now are very close with here in Buffalo, Ed Cardone.
Mm-hmm.
And talk a little bit about perhaps maybe how your relationships with artists in the community here might have impacted your work in some way.
When I first met Ed, he was writing fiction, and he was a good writer, and he still is a good writer. But I don't think he writes, unless he's working secretly, which could be. I don't think he's writing fiction anymore. So, but he's has done a terrific job down at Hall Walls as an administrator, as a director. Doing everything he's done down there. I mean, you know, you have Tammy McGovern, who is an artist as well as a great, incredible coder.
Yeah.
And so I could call that a collaboration.
Yeah.
Pardon me. I've used one of Polly Little's. I took a photograph of one of her images, and that was for the piece Lord's Prayer, you're pointing your finger like you remember it.
Well, yeah, I was just looking at it earlier today, and I was wondering what that second image was, because
that's Polly Little. And she has credit.
Awesome.
She's got credit on the site.
Right.
Just for people who might hear this, I mean, you know, that's a piece where I took the Lord's Prayer. This is actually one of the most difficult pieces I had in terms of the text that I had ever had to do. As you know, but you have the Lord's Prayer, and then you have a sound, you know, there's an audio, and there's an image behind it, a classic image. I don't remember, but I've given it credit. But it's a, you know, classical, you know, religious image, iconography.
Mm-hmm.
And then you click, and it shakes. It starts shaking back and forth, and the letters in the Lord's Prayer start to move apart from each other. And then you shake it again, and each time the letters move more, further and further apart, and as you know, by the time you get to the fourth, I think it's the third end of the third shake or the fourth shake, all the letters have moved and then rearranged themselves in an entirely new poem. That was really difficult. Taking the exact words of the Lord's Prayer and then rearranging them and to make an intelligible poem, that took me a long time. And I actually had to cheat. I think I made a contraction where there wasn't one. It was hard. That was a difficult piece. But once again, Polly Little did the image for that, and great image. It seemed perfect for that.
It does. That's what it stood out. I didn't know who did at the time because I didn't look at the credits.
She's a great artist.
She is.
I like her work a lot. I like Mark Levitelli, too, her husband. But in terms of, you know, in terms of what I do, there's not too many electronic literature writers here in Buffalo, New York. There's Lost Glacier over at UB.
Mm-hmm.
There's me. So collaboration. I'm a solo. It's an interesting question. If I can quickly do a follow up, because people have asked Andy Campbell, the guy I just mentioned, Dreaming Methods. He's been wanting to do a collaboration with me for quite a long time, and I keep on putting him off, and I feel bad about it. But I just like the solo flight. I've always been kind of a solo person, and I like doing the solo thing. And eventually, I'll do collaborations in the real true sense of the word. But then, of course, one could always claim that if I'm using clip art and if I'm taking videos off the web, you know, with permission, those are collaborations of a sort, right? A collaborative montage.
Mm-hmm.
So you could make I could make a claim that actually I've been collaborating all along.
Yeah, collaborative collage even.
Yeah, but not locally.
Yeah,
as much as I'd like to. Oh, actually, I shouldn't forget Brad Wales. I attended his class at UB. He invited me to come into his graduate class, architecture class. And because I had come up to him at some party where I had a couple of beers, and I said to him, I'd love to collaborate. Actually, I did tell him this. I did say, I'd love to collaborate, because what I wanted to do was to have him create a sculpture that I could put a iPad into, and then make it, the iPad would have a piece on it, be interactive, but it would be within a sculpture. And I kind of liked that idea of electrons and steel, you know, put together. And so we actually started working on it. We had his students actually came up with some ideas. But then, as you know, Brad got very involved in this project here at the Birchfield. So my emails to him have remained unanswered.
Oh.
So I wanted to follow up on him, but no luck. One other thing on this just occurred to me. You know, people don't talk about this very often, but, you know, a type of collaborator for someone like me is, I appear in every year, a certain amount of festivals and galleries and so forth, right? Well, you wouldn't think electronic literature would, but you'd be surprised. Curators are collaborators too, because how they set your piece up, where they put it in the gallery, how inventive they get with that can be an act of collaboration as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen it happen. This piece I did for a gallery in California, I don't remember, there was something. They actually had a special table they made. They must have had it. Completely white, with a white chair, and then they put my piece on top of it, and it looked gorgeous. It was like, I had to email them and say, thank you, some of your curatorial skills are incredible. Thank you so much. that can sometimes work as well.
Okay, now we're going to get into some broad questions, such as, is there anything that you hope to achieve with your art, or anything that you have hoped to achieve with your art, or your writing, let's say? Is there anything you hope to achieve with your writing?
All right, not just the aesthetic level, presumably. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I'm always trying to, you know, one-up myself and try to create something that I would consider to be beautiful or enduring or worthwhile. Right. Putting that aside, mm-hmm. you know, just in terms of pure greed, then it would be, you know, I've been in a lot of festivals, galleries, publications, etc. Lots. You know, probably, I don't know, the last 5 years or so, probably averaging 20 to 25 to 30 a year. So, but what I found with these festivals and galleries is that, you know, it's a part of, you know, these aren't, by the way, these are group shows. You know, there's no, my market, you know, I wouldn't want to go to a solo show of an artist like myself, because it'd be like a bunch of computers set up. That's not very interesting. Now, I've had actually retrospectives that were solo shows, right? But it doesn't matter. All these things, they don't really create traffic, web traffic. They're one-offs. They're incidental events that really don't... They contribute to the resume, but they don't really contribute to the readership or the viewership. So what I like to do is I want to break through. I want a broader audience to recognize that what I and other many people like myself do is actually interesting and fun, and that it's worthwhile, and it's mainstream. It's already mainstream, right? But I want people to recognize that it's mainstream, and I don't see any reason why either me or someone else, who are doing what I do, can't become mainstream, mm-hmm. all right? I'm not talking household words here. We're just talking mainstream readership, you know, in terms of like, you know, not in the verge, not in the edge, but someplace more towards the center. Now, also, although this is a good start for me, I mean, I'd like to have more of local visibility. I mean, I've been spending a lot of time looking at international events and stuff like that, you know, but I haven't really, I've kind of neglected my local obligation, if you will. So this is a good start. And actually, I mean, this is when it rains, it pours. Like, so it's like, this is a brush up for that. Yeah. Although that interview will be a lot less detailed than this.
Really?
Oh yeah, it'll be five questions. Yeah. You know, do you look good in plaid? Yeah. Do you look good in plaid? Yeah. Stuff like that. So I don't know what the questions are, but that would be like, you know, yeah. Buffalo Spree. I love Buffalo Spree. My wife is the, you know, editor-in-chief of Buffalo Spree, so it's my favorite magazine of every magazine in the world. None excluded. Seriously. You know, I don't ask for a lot, and I'm happy for what I've got, but I just like to think that this, that electronic literature has more to offer to the general public than it does currently.
Mm-hmm. In the aims of increasing your local visibility, what are some of your needs as an artist that the larger community that you're a part of here in Western New York can provide to you? What are some things you need from the Western New York community that would help you advance your career?
I'd like to do more performances locally. I've done only one here at the Birchfield. I'm actually invited today to do one at Medai. And I think that's it. I think that's the only performances I've done. E-Poetry was here 1 year, so I did a performance in Squeaky Wheel for that part of that. Mm-hmm. But really, it's been very low-key, very low-key. So, I mean, I like to perform. I'd love to do more performances locally. I would be interested in curating an electronic literature show. But the only problem with it is it's kind of boring in terms of technology. It's not, you know, it can work. I mean, I was just in a show at, I'm going to drop names, at the Library of Congress. I went down and did a reading there too, all right? And a lot of people came by, and they were, and kids too enjoyed it. It was like, you know, people were playing with the pieces, and actually they had typewriters, manual typewriters, and some of these kids had never seen a manual typewriter, and they're asking, how do you? They're hitting the keys and saying, but it doesn't write. And then you tell them, hit it harder. And then they weren't sure how to spool the paper. It was a lost technology. In any case, the show was really interesting, and it proved that you can actually have a show of electronic literature as long as you put some other cool stuff in there, that like regular typewriter, you know, manual typewriters. But the bottom line for me is that as artworks, it's difficult to display them as artworks. I mean, you have a desktop computer. I mean, iPads, a little more arty, right? Especially if you can embed them in something. But, you know, desktop computers, laptops, the cachet is kind of gone. You know, you're inviting people to come to a gallery for a unique experience, not to come and do something they can do at home. And so I love to curate, Kathy Immer Behrens, okay, and Deanie Grieger. Okay, Kathy Immer Behrens and Deanie Grieger curated the show at the Library of Congress in April of 2013. And that show, like I said, I was in a piece in that show, and I also performed at the Library of Congress as well. And the show was great because they were able to put all sorts of different things involved into the show. There were different technologies. But once again, bottom line, listen, you know, I'm going to come to a gallery so I can, you know, I can play with an iPad that I can play with at home. So I'd want to talk to someone. That would be interest me. Like, not just simply to do more performances, but also to talk to someone about the possibilities of how do you curate or create a show of electronic literature in such a way that it's actually a unique experience.
What I think is interesting is that you're talking about curation as a three-dimensional experience, but there is a lot to be said about digital curation and the curation of online exhibitions. For us, for example, there are so many works by Charles Birchfield, and through a digital medium, we can curate exhibitions that we could never curate in person.
That's a really good point. Yeah. And actually, that's actually the natural fit.
Right.
I've actually curated such online shows before.
My last question for you is fairly unique given the media that you work in. But imagine a young writer in a similar vein to you. I don't even want to call them electronic writer, I just want to call them a writer. But imagine a young writer who works in similar media. What advice do you have for them starting to explore this field?
Dagnabbit. There's always got to be that question, isn't there? Jeez.
Or you could even say, if you could talk to yourself in 1998, you know, what are some things even you would say to yourself to think of that you know now that you didn't know then?
I do have the answers to these. One, as I said before, and I think probably the most important, never create anything that you wouldn't want to read yourself and enjoy reading yourself. Two, know enough about the context within which you're creating to know whether what you're creating is new or not. Three, always take risks. Never be satisfied with following the norm. Push yourself further than you would have imagined. Five, never be satisfied. There's no six. No, six, let there never be a six. Five is enough. That's your fingers in the hand right
there.
That's
a handful.
Yeah, it's a handful.
Literally a handful. Alan, is there anything else you would like to say?
No, thank you. You've been a very perceptive and a interviewer and a great listener.
Thank you.
And some very good questions, probing and making me think. Appreciate that. And I, just for the record, I really appreciate what the Birchfield is doing. I'm honored and pleased to be a living legacy.
And Alan, we are so excited to have you participate in the second year of the project. I mean, what you do is really unique, even within the diverse types of art that we're trying to encapsulate with this project. And we're so excited to be able to have this time to talk more about it.